Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Does an adversity-driven culture contribute to economic growth? Consider Israel. The country is young, small, short on natural resources, and surrounded by enemy states. It is a frequent target of terrorists, and its young people are required to put in at least 2 years of full-time military service before they are eligible for a college education. Yet my guest today would argue that those very hardships have played into an entrepreneurial culture that is among the most innovative and technologically savvy on Earth. Dan Senor is adjunct senior fellow for Middle East Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. His new book, written with Saul Singer, is called Startup Nation, The Story of Israel's Economic Miracle. Dan, welcome to Think.
Good to be with you, Chris.
You write that Israel contains the greatest concentration of innovation and entrepreneurship in the world today. How does it compare with other developed countries in terms of what it's doing?
Well, first of all, the data is pretty striking. Let me just give you a couple of measures. One, there are more Israeli companies on the NASDAQ today, on the NASDAQ's sort of tech-heavy stock exchange, than there are companies from any country in the world outside the United States, more than all of India, China, Korea, Japan, and all of Europe combined. If you look at global venture capital, which is the most fungible measure of technological promise, venture capital investors don't invest based on theology or nationalism or based on ideology. They invest based on where they think they're going to get outsized returns. And on an annual basis, just look at 2008, if you look at per capita numbers, Israel attracts more global venture capital than any country in the world, including the United States, 2.5 times more than the United States, 30 times more than Europe, 80 times more than China, and over 300 times more than India. So it is this extremely dynamic startup economy. But to your question, there are plenty of places in the world, plenty of countries that are innovative. There's lots of innovation happening in Finland, for example. Fantastic scientists there who, that has among the highest number of patents per capita coming out of Finland. There are plenty of countries in the world where there's a lot of innovation, but there isn't a lot of entrepreneurship. You talk to their governmental leaders, and their frustration is that their young people aren't starting new companies. On the other hand, you can look around the world and see a lot of, entrepreneurialism. There's lots of entrepreneurialism throughout Asia. There's lots of entrepreneurialism throughout, go to Thailand. There's lots of small business entrepreneurialism. You go to the Arab world. There's lots of bazaars and shooks that are very entrepreneurial, but there isn't innovation. They aren't coming up with new ideas, radical solutions to solve really big problems. And what makes Israel unique, what we argue in the book, is that it's this combination of entrepreneurialism and innovation that exists in Israel like nowhere else in the world.
It's really striking here the way you describe how young people are as they innovate these new ideas and start these new businesses, and the fact that people are willing to trust them. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, part of it comes from the military experience. Every single Israeli has to serve in the military. Men 18 years old, women, everyone at age 18, men for 3 years and women for 2 years. They go through this crucible leadership experience before they go to university. So by age 20, 21, 22, depending if they go into officer training, they've had this incredible experience. They've learned what it's meant to lead people, what it means to have lives on the line, what it means to manage people, manage millions of dollars of equipment and assets, what it means to have to make decisions every single day with imperfect information and lots of ambiguity. Parenthetically, the Israeli military is the least hierarchical military in the world. If you look at the pyramid of the command structure of the Israeli military, where at the bottom of the pyramid, horizontally, you have the rank and file. And at the top of the pyramid, the tip, you have the officer corps. And you compare that pyramid to other militaries in the world, Israel has the most narrow tip of any military in the world, meaning there are very few commanders, which means there are very few bosses, which means the junior people have to learn how to make decisions on their own and improvise because there are very few people to turn to for commands. So it creates this culture at a young age where young people are fully comfortable and prepared and embrace the whole notion of taking on a lot of responsibility, which lends itself perfectly well for a startup environment.
And the other thing that is notable is the fact that years before they show up for their first day of service in the IDF, they are thinking about what it's going to take to get themselves into an elite unit.
Yeah. I mean, this is the way here in the United States, our top performers are sitting there debating Harvard, Princeton, Yale, MIT. You know, they're sitting there having these debates about what school to get into. In Israel, at age 16 and 17 years old, every single Israeli has already thought about whether or not they want to be in the Mamram unit or the Talpiot unit or the 8200 unit. These are all different units. Or one of the, one of the commando units, the special forces units. All these different units have their own legacy. Every one of these units train the Israelis with a specific set of skill sets. And every single Israeli has a point of view, Air Force, intelligence units, at age 16 and 17 years old, which unit they want to be in, and then how to navigate to get into that unit. The way our students said, how do they get a good SAT? How do they get in, what do they need to do to position themselves to get into the right school? The Israelis are trying to position themselves to get into the right unit.
And then that military service, once they've completed their full-time in the IDF, serves as a sort of shorthand to future employers. By mentioning what unit you've been in, you can sort of tell them something about yourself.
Yeah, every Israeli employer, whether they're leaders of companies, whether they are venture capital investors, every single Israeli employer or deployer of capital is literate about the Israeli military experience. They're literate about a military resume. They can look at a military resume and say, oh, you served in the 8200 unit. I understand that trains you for X, Y, and Z. They immediately, it is the guidepost that they use. Now, what was striking to us in this book, we interview a lot of Israeli inventors and entrepreneurs, which was fascinating, just because we wrote the book, we tell the story through the eyes and through the stories of these different inventors and entrepreneurs, but we also in Israel. But we also do it through the perspective of, or from the perspective of, foreign investors or the leaders of multinational companies that have invested in Israel and get their perspective. So you take someone like Eric Schmidt, who we interviewed for the book, who is the CEO and president of Google. Eric Schmidt said to us, I asked him the question. So what makes the Israeli entrepreneur so unique? And I thought I would get some kind of generic answer. I thought before we dove deep into the interview. And he said, as far as I'm concerned, the best engineering executive in the world will always be a tank commander from the Israeli Defense Forces who has fought in one of the wars with Syria. Not to get into a debate about what this war versus that war, I was just struck by the level of specificity with which he spoke, which means it's not only Israeli employers who have gotten literate about what specific skill sets in the Israeli military are transferable to the business environment. It was a foreign investor, it was a CEO of a U.S. company, a multinational, that had that view. Now, Google has a huge presence in Israel, as does Cisco and eBay and Intel, and we go through these different companies and look at their operations in Israel. But I was struck that their American executives are that fluid about the different skill sets one develops in the Israeli military.
Dan Senor is my guest. His new book is called Startup Nation, The Story of Israel's Economic Miracle. I want to talk for a minute about the culture in Israel and how that contributes to things. There's a wonderful story in here about Intel and about a processor development team that was not shy about arguing for what it knew was right.
Well, it's an amazing story. There was a couple decades ago, Intel, which manufactures the chips that power all our computers and laptops, was running into a problem. The measurement that was used for how advanced a chip was called clock speed. Basically, I'm oversimplifying. In the book, we go into much more detail, but it was basically the speed with which the chip could process information, process instructions. And it was all about clock speed. It was all about getting clock speed faster and faster and faster and faster. And that was the way the industry measured progress in terms of the advancement and modernization of these chips. And the problem the industry was running into was as you got faster and faster clock speed, the chips would overheat, and they would overheat these computers. Now, it was fine if you were working with big computers in your office because they could install fans in the computers, and they could cool down the entire system. The problem, however, was for laptops because you can't put a big fan in the laptop or it completely, you know, makes the purpose of the laptop, which is portability, obsolete. So they had run into this thing called the wall. They called it the wall. You know, it was an industry term. They'd hit the wall because it was only so fast, so much speed you could get before you dealt with this overheating problem. The team in Israel came up with another way of doing this. And they basically applied, if you think about driving a car, and, you know, you normally hit the gas pedal and you go faster and faster and faster. Well, you look at a stick shift and you can switch gears and get speed without just leaning on the gas pedal the whole time and getting you know, rapid increases in speed. They applied a similar model. They experimented with a similar model to the chip, which meant that you still got speed with which the instructions were being implemented on the chip, but you weren't powering through at the speed with which that would overheat the computer. But it meant dispensing with this measurement, which the Israelis believed was arbitrary, called clock speed. They figured out a different way to do it. You still got the same result. In fact, you got a better result, but it meant dispensing with the notion of clock speed. So the Israelis said, ta-da, presto, great idea. So they went to the headquarters in Santa Clara, California, and said, we've solved the problem. And the executive team in Santa Clara said, go fly a kite. Clock speed is the only measurement the industry uses. We can't just say we're coming up with a new approach. We've just got to make clock speed work. Our stock will take a hit if on Wall Street if it looks like we're not taking clock speed seriously. And the Israelis went to such lengths to persuade Santa Clara of this. They started taking these trips to California, the 20-hour flight from Israel, and would literally do these ambushes of executives at the headquarters over and over and over to push and probe and challenge and shove in order to get their point across, to say to Santa Clara, to the Intel headquarters, you're wrong. You're wrong on this. And they ultimately prevailed. And today, the system that was developed by the Israeli team is the one that we use today to power all our computers, and it mitigated this, what seemed like this insurmountable problem.
And it was initially sort of stunning for the folks at Intel that the Israelis didn't seem to take it personally to walk into a room and start shouting at the top of their lungs and getting really emotionally worked up about this.
No, it's true, Chris. I mean, the Israelis, the culture there, and, you know, in a sense, it comes back to this military experience I was talking about. It's a very anti-hierarchical military. So junior people in the military it's not only acceptable for junior people to challenge the decisions and to debate the judgments of the commanders, but they are encouraged to do so. If you are a junior person in the IDF and you see someone doing something wrong at the senior levels, you are supposed to say so. You're supposed to speak up. You're not just supposed to implement blindly. And this culture of challenging and probing and debating follows the Israelis into their startups. Now, sometimes it puts off senior management in American companies.
Let me stop you right there. We need to take a quick break. Dan Senor is my guest. He's adjunct senior fellow for Middle East Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. His new book is called Startup Nation, The Story of Israel's Economic Miracle. You can join us now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, announcing a new 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/plano-cfp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Dan Senor. He is adjunct senior fellow for Middle East Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. His new book, written with Saul Singer, is called Startup Nation, The Story of Israel's Economic Miracle. You can be part of the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. Dan, in stark contrast to the United States and many other developed countries, Israeli leaders gain support by promising to encourage immigration. And then when those immigrants arrive, they are immediately granted full citizenship. Can you talk about the impact of those policies on the business climate?
It's a huge help. It's a huge factor. We have a whole chapter in the book on immigration. And let me preface this by saying the following. I come at this issue with a bias. I'm a son of an immigrant, but I'm also someone who's worked in a lot of different business settings and spent a lot of time looking at what makes economies competitive. And I believe that one of the big factors in making the United States, the American economy, competitive over the decades has been that no matter what has been going on in the U.S. economy, during the ups and during the downs, one constant has been, the one shock absorber, if you will, has been that no matter what's going on in the world, the best and the brightest from around the planet have wanted to come to the United States. And the same is true for Israel, that you have this incredibly hardworking, talented, tenacious people from around the world who want to go to Israel. And Israel has made it a policy to welcome them, to embrace them, to bring them into the country. We argue that immigrants are the ultimate entrepreneurs. Why? Because they're the ultimate risk takers. Why? Because they turn their lives upside down to start again, to start anew. And they know what it means to deal with adversity. They know what it means to deal with failure. They know what it means to deal with disappointment. And they keep trying. They keep at it. And it's no surprise that so many of the major technology companies in the United States have been started by immigrants or the children or grandchildren of immigrants. And the same is true in Israel. Two out of every three Israelis are either an immigrant, the child of an immigrant, or the grandchild of an immigrant. Most of them are actually immigrants themselves or the children of immigrants. Israel has over 70 nationalities represented in the country. So when you go to Israel, you're interacting with Ethiopian Jews, with Polish Jews, with Iranian Jews, with Iraqi Jews, with Ukrainian Jews, Australians, from all over the world. And so not only is it that they've brought in all these people from around the world, and often people say, well, it's not that diverse because they're all Jewish. You hear this from time to time. People say that to me. And it's true they're all Jewish or they're mostly Jewish. But while a common prayer book and a history of persecution counts for something, most of these people don't have anything in common. They come from all corners of the planet. And yet they interact with each other, they work with each other, they serve with each other in the military, and they are not only hardworking and tenacious for all the reasons that immigrants are generally, but they also develop webs of networks around the world by interacting with one another. So the son of an Iranian immigrant in Israel will build a relationship with the daughter of a Ukrainian immigrant, and suddenly that Iranian has access to a web of relationships in a completely different part of the world, which is enormously important for this very globalized world we live in. So the Israeli government's success, over years have figured out how important this is. And they almost challenge, the politicians challenge one another. You know, when you watch a debate for prime minister, for during the election season, the candidates for prime minister say, under my premiership, we'll immigrate 1.5 million people. And the other one will say, well, under my premiership, we'll immigrate 2 million people. And they're trying to debate who can outbid one another and how many people they'll bring in, not how many they'll keep out, which is the tone of the debate today in this country, in the United States. So they have very innovative policies, which we talk about in the book, as it relates to assimilation that the U.S. can learn from. So it's a very important role.
You have some fascinating analysis in the book that seems quite prescient on the differences between the Israeli economy and the economy in Dubai, which seems especially fitting to talk about given the events of the past week. What does Israel have going for it that Dubai does not?
Well, you know, it's yeah, you're right. We have a whole chapter on Dubai, and we basically predicted when we wrote the book that Dubai would blow up, or at least it wasn't sustainable. And it's not only for the reasons that are being cited today in the popular press, which were obviously they were overextended, and they were, you know, over-leveraged, and there wasn't a clear distinction between the finances of the sheikh, of the leader of Dubai, and the finances of the state. There wasn't a clear line. That was part of the problem. The other part of the problem, though, Chris, was that Dubai had, in many respects, an opportunity. It was the only Gulf country or the only Gulf city state that had no oil, or very little oil. I mean, relative to its neighbor, Abu Dhabi, and certainly relative to Saudi Arabia, it had virtually no oil. So the early pioneers of Dubai 30 years ago said, look, we've got to come up with a different economic development strategy because we don't have the benefit of being able to be dependent on oil. Now, there were a number of ways they could have gone. They could have gone the Israeli route, which is to say we're going to build an innovation, entrepreneurship-based economy. We're going to have a very liberal economy. We're going to encourage people to come here from all over the world to start companies, develop new ideas, and transform whole industries. Instead, they went another route. They said, we're going to build clusters, economic clusters, which is a very common model for economic development, which was first termed by the legendary Michael Porter at Harvard Business School, which is to say, look, if you just bring in a lot of people from different industries and you cluster them together, you concentrate them together and let them do their thing, you'll have a lot of economic activity. In our case, they argued, in Dubai's case, we will be the pathway point to a couple of billion people all throughout Asia and the former Soviet Union and the Arab world, and we will be the and given our huge port, we will be the one economy where people can come in through here freely and export and re-export all their goods and services. And they went about doing that, and they said all these industries can come in tax-free and set up shop. And that is true. According to Michael Porter's theory, that does create a cluster. What was missing, though, which is another critical ingredient in a cluster, is you need people in this cluster, and they created Dubai Internet City, Dubai Media City, Dubai Healthcare City. All of these were clusters. You also need what Porter says is a sense of emotional connection. The question is, do people who come to the cluster feel a connection to the development of that cluster, of that city, of that country, that goes beyond just economic gain? Because if they don't feel a sense of connection in building the place where they're living in, you won't have the long-term economic durability that you need, because people are just going to try and come, make a quick buck, and then leave and go back to where, whence they came, you know, Saudi Arabia, London, wherever they were coming from. And the Emiratis in Dubai never calculated for that. They just said this will be a freewheeling place. People can come in and come out, and they won't have to make any real commitment to the long-term building of this place. And that's exactly what happened. They came in, they built a lot of stuff, things blew up, and they all left. And there's nothing left to speak for in this mirage, in this facade that is Dubai. And I don't want to go on too long, but I'll say three other factors that are missing in Dubai. One are immigrants. We talked about immigration earlier. There are no real immigrants in Dubai. They have day laborers or temporary laborers that come in from South Asia.
Yeah, you can't become a citizen even if you want to.
Right. They're not integrated into society. They're not part of the society. So even when Dubai tried to bring in all this academic talent from around the world, who were, you know, they were elites, but they were treated, you know, in their wherever they came from. But at the end of the day, they were treated like second-class citizens. Two, women, I mean, Emirati women are treated like second-class citizens. So that basically subordinates, you know, half of the labor force. And then three, there's no tolerance for questioning authorities, questioning government. There's no real democracy in Dubai. One of my favorite quotes from the book is a leading official from the Dubai government, when they actually tried to experiment with elections, said, I don't understand why turnout was so low. You know, the candidates we chose were from all the best families. They don't understand, you know, so, I mean, they never had real, and you can't have an innovation-based and an entrepreneur-based economy without real experimentation. You can't have real experimentation without real questioning. And you can't have real questioning if people can't challenge authority and challenge the elites. And you just don't have that in Dubai.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Dan Senor is my guest. We're talking about his new book, Startup Nation, The Story of Israel's Economic Miracle. Let's speak to Tim in Dallas. Hello, Tim.
Hi there. Great conversation, as always. I'm struck, first and foremost, by what I'm hearing in terms of what I guess you could kind of call the Israeli system that is producing the results that your guest is able to give us, is very concrete. Results and evidence of the way that this works and how it works well. And at the same time, I think about, since this is ultimately kind of in some ways connected to what can happen here in America, it makes me think of the fact that what it feels like in America now is that what he describes in terms of the mindset that exists in Israel, it sounds a lot like the good old-fashioned American values that are very, very quick to be spouted out by the average American. But quite frankly, you wouldn't necessarily be able to throw out the same type of concrete evidence that we're doing what we're saying that we're doing. So my question for the guest would be that, obviously you could ask the question, is the average American or is the American society capable of learning from Israel? I think maybe for myself, the bigger question is that given the fact that we're so now rooted in this idea of rhetoric versus, based on somebody's opinion, the outcome of the rhetoric in terms of productivity, is the average American interested? Are we interested in learning a new system, even if we can see how productive it actually is?
Those are great questions, Tim. Thanks for your call. What do you think, Dan?
Oh, I think there's tremendous interest. One of the things that sparked our curiosity in this subject, Tim, is that in September of 2008, when the economy blew up here in the United States, Lehman filed for bankruptcy, there was a debate among academics, economists in the United States, about what went wrong. And Robert Solow, who we refer to quite a bit in the book, who's the legendary MIT economist, Nobel economist, he wrote this paper many years ago that argued that you don't get real sustainable economic growth without productivity gains. At the end of the day, unless you have real productivity gains, it's not real growth. What we had in the United States, to your point, Tim, over the last few years, was a proxy for economic growth. It wasn't real economic growth. It was faux economic growth. It was growth based on near zero interest rates, easy credit, inflated real estate prices. It wasn't real. And so the question became, how do you get back to productivity gains? Well, as Solow argued, you don't get real productivity gains without innovation. And at the end of the day, you don't get real innovation without real technological innovation. And most technological innovations, real transformative innovations, happen in small companies, in the small startup. Google was once a small company, and their most transformative innovation was started by, when they were just a handful of folks, which was Internet search. eBay, it was the whole idea of an Internet-based global auction was discovered by fewer than 30 people in Pierre Omidyar's apartment in San Jose. So small startups is where some of the most transformative innovations have happened around the world. And as Business Week magazine asked at the time on its cover in September of 2008, can America invent its way back? Can we get back to these inventive, innovation-based, entrepreneurial roots of ours? And that is what the Israeli economy is. That is the model. And I am struck, Tim, since the book has come out, how much interest there is. I've been approached by leaders of our own government here in the United States, by the Obama administration. I've been approached by members of state governments, by governor's offices. We've been approached by the U.S. military, by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce that's looking to work with the U.S. military and corporate America about how to integrate this incredible military talent that we have here in the United States and how to educate people about the value of that talent and those skill sets for the economy. So we're hearing from a range of people. New York City, Mayor Bloomberg's government, I'm here in New York, has approached us. So I think there's deep interest in this.
You have a great story here about the nearly direct application of skills that were picked up in the military that ultimately have really benefited PayPal's internet security system, their anti-fraud system. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, it's an amazing story. The president of PayPal is a guy named Scott Thompson, former executive at Visa for a number of years. He was approached by Benchmark Capital, which is a big venture capital firm in California, which was the seed investor in eBay. eBay owns PayPal. And Scott Thompson was asked by Benchmark if he'd meet with this small company called Fraud Sciences, which is a small Tel Aviv company, a startup founded by some young guys coming out of the military there, that they believed had the solution to deal with online identity theft and fraud, e-commerce fraud. And Benchmark wanted to invest in the company. And they, as part of their due diligence, they asked Scott Thompson if he'd meet with the founders. And he goes, so one of the founders goes to meet with Scott Thompson. And Scott, who's a very busy guy and who we interviewed for the book, who's a great character, says, all right, what do you got? And he says, well, we figured out how to defeat fraud online. Scott says, okay, how do you do that? And he says, well, it really comes down to this. The world is divided between good people and bad people. He says, good people, good actors on the web leave lots of traces of themselves, lots of footprints. Right? If you think about it, it's actually kind of true.
They've got nothing to hide.
Sorry?
They've got nothing to hide.
Nothing to hide. They leave, you know, Facebook, MySpace, Twitter, blogging. I mean, you know, they let it all hang out.
Let me have you stop there because we need to take another break. We'll leave it as a little cliffhanger. Dan Senor is my guest. He's adjunct senior fellow for Middle East Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. His new book is called Startup Nation, The Story of Israel's Economic Miracle. We will take more of your calls after the break. You can get to us by phoning 1-800-933-5372, or you can direct email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, announcing a new 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/plano-cfp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Dan Senor is my guest. We're talking about his new book, Startup Nation, The Story of Israel's Economic Miracle. So you have your good actors on the internet who leave traces of themselves, Dan, and then you have your bad eggs.
Your bad actors, right, who even those who use assumed identities, who use fictitious identities on the web, according to the founders of this Israeli startup, Fraud Sciences, they still leave very few footprints, because even if it's a fictitious identity, they're still insecure about revealing too much about themselves. And so what the Shvat Shached, who's the founder of Fraud Sciences, figured out, and his team, is they developed these algorithms that showed a correlation between people who left a lot of footprints on the web and whether or not they were a low credit risk, and people who left very few footprints on the web, very few data points, and they were a high credit risk. So they just, if someone applied for, say, PayPal, they could just take their profile and scour the web and try to calculate how many times that person has sort of appeared on the web, if you will, and then apply, and then input that information into their algorithm, and it would spit out what kind of credit risk they were. It was an amazing idea. It blew away Scott Thompson, who's the president of PayPal.
And Shaquette had used this before for hunting terrorists.
Right. So Scott Thompson's sort of intrigued, and he says to Shvat, where did you learn how to do this? And he said, when I was in the military, I had to hunt, monitor the activities of terrorists online. we used a similar methodology. So he turned this into a business, and Scott Thompson gave Shvat Shahed, 40,000 files, PayPal files, and said, okay, I'm a little skeptical. He gave them 100,000 files. He said, try this out. Try your methodology with these 100,000 files. We've already done our work on these 100,000 files. We know the answers on all these people, but let's see how you do. And he thought he would never hear from them again because it had taken Fraud Sciences 5 years to get through 40,000 files. So when he handed them 100,000, he thought, I'll never hear from him again. And Shvat Shahed got on a plane, flew back to Tel Aviv, and something like 3 days later, he emailed Scott back and said, we're done. He showed them the 100,000 files. Scott Thompson turned the files over to the PayPal engineers to inspect them, and they came back to him and said, on every metric, in every category, the Israeli team did better than we did. And, you know, literally within weeks, maybe months, PayPal had bought Fraud Sciences for close to $200 million. So it was an amazing story.
And the other, the last thing that I want to talk about here is that the other interesting thing about the Israelis is that they gave a figure that they would sell the company for, and they didn't leave room for sort of bargaining. They just said what they thought it was worth and didn't really expect anyone to come back and argue with them.
Yeah, it's true. It's funny. You know, in that situation, you know, the PayPal made an offer to Fraud Sciences for something like $80 million. They calculated the company was worth. And the truth was, Fraud Sciences was not interested in selling the company. They just were trying to raise capital from Benchmark, which is why the meeting with PayPal happened in the first place. And they said, no, we're not interested. And finally, you know, they said, well, if you were to sell it, what would you sell it for? And they said, well, we would sell it for what it's worth. And they were talking closer to $200 million. And the way Scott Thompson, who we spent a lot of time with in the book, who's just a terrific character, he said, you know, I'd never seen anything like this before. The Israelis had a view of what their company was worth. They were just very matter-of-fact about it. They weren't bending. They weren't willing to compromise. They were totally confident in its value, and they weren't going to budge. And he thought that they had a poker face on, and they were just negotiating, and they weren't. And it's very, there's this sort of no-nonsense quality to Israeli entrepreneurs that Scott was dealing with.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Pakosh in Hearst. Hi, Pakosh.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
The question that I had is the immigrants, many of them who are coming to America and who are starting businesses, unlike the past, many of them are highly educated. They don't have any language problems or the cultural problems. And so when they start a business, now it's not like in the past where they're really trying to better their lives. It's like they're doing it out of greed, but it is good for the economy. So why is it that the immigrants are doing it, while the Americans who are born and brought up here, like my children, they don't seem to do this type of thing?
Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
I think it's a little bit what you were talking about before, Dan, that immigrants are sort of risk takers. But do you have any perspective on that?
Well, is he asking why? He broke up a bit. He's asking why immigrants are such risk takers, but the children of immigrants are not?
Yeah. Why it tends to be immigrants who are innovating and being entrepreneurial.
Oh, I think, I mean, right. As I was saying before, immigrants, look at what they've been through. I mean, my mother, all right, just to give you an example, my mother was from Košice, Slovakia, a small town, which she was chased out of by the Nazis. Her father was killed in Auschwitz. She was on the run for a number of years during the war. She made it out. Then she came back to Slovakia after the war. Then the Soviets came in, her and her family left again. And, you know, her experience isn't unique. She was bouncing around, constantly on the run, learning what it means to start life anew, to learn a new language, to get settled in a new society. It's very difficult. It's very hard. Shai Agassi, we opened the book with a story about a guy named Shai Agassi, who is the founder of a company called Better Place. Now, Shai Agassi is a fascinating character. For those considering reading our book, if you don't have time to read the entire book, if you're going to do nothing else, just read the introduction, because the introduction is a story of Shai Agassi, who is trying to single-handedly, with the company he has built, get Israel and other countries completely off of oil with this electric or battery-operated car he's developing and this national grid for swapping batteries in and out in a matter of minutes for the length of time it would take you to get your gas, your tank of gas filled. Shai Agassi, who's an amazing entrepreneur and has had tremendous success in the software. He's an executive at SAP and is, you know, at 40 years old. He founded a startup that was bought by SAP, made a lot of money there. He's the son of an Iraqi immigrant. His dad, who also works for his company, came from Basra, Iraq, who had a big job at the government in Basra, Iraq. After, you know, in the late 40s, there was a big purge in these pogroms, basically, in much of the Arab world. And Shai Agassi, his dad, Reuven Agassi, lost his job. They moved to Israel. They lived in tent cities in these shanty towns in Israel, the equivalent of refugee camps. And they had to start again. They had to start all over again. And this is very consistent with the sort of entrepreneurial ethos of successful CEOs of startups. This sense of, I'll start again, I'll start over, I'll keep trying till I get it right. It's just a character trait that's very consistent.
Dan Senor is my guest. The new book is called Startup Nation. Let's go next on the phone to, we'll go to Janet in Fort Worth. Hi, Janet.
Oh, hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Sure. Listen, I don't want to sound negative, I guess, because I think that your guest has raised a number of exciting and really inspiring points, but I just feel as though it's a bit disingenuous to downplay the potential of, the extent to which Jewish identity plays in the, say, for example, influx of Jewish immigrants from around the world to Israel, the, you know, citizenship rights that are extended, the commitment that people develop to, to the culture, to the health of the nation and that kind of thing. You know, I think that that's incredibly important. And then I guess the other point I just wanted to make was that it seems to me that this sort of unstemmed influx of immigrants to Israel does create incredible stresses on the natural environment there. And, you know, also, might it not contribute to displacement of Palestinians in Israel? And I guess those are my questions or comments.
Thanks for your call.
Okay.
Well, let me, the first question about, you know, sort of the, I think the question was about whether or not, even if they're immigrants, they're sort of smart, talented immigrants because they're all Jewish. Is that the question?
Janet, was that what you were talking about?
Intelligence. It just had to do with, identifying as Jews with a place to go. I mean, you know, good heavens, if you have people fleeing pogroms, they can go to a place where they know that as Jews they are not going to be, that it's going to be a very positive environment for them, you know. I mean, it's important to feel you have a safe place to be.
Okay.
So it doesn't have to do with, you know, some myth or reality of, you know, greater Jewish intelligence or whatever. That's not it.
Right. Well, I think that's right. But the what some of the Jewish immigrants that have come into Israel, most of them have had to go through to get there, is equally challenging, if not more challenging in some cases, than what immigrants to the United States have had to go through. I mean, we profile some of these stories, like the airlifts from Ethiopia to bring the Ethiopian immigrants into Israel. Or you look at, we have this amazing story in the book where you know, people had to, from Yemen, and I think it was in the 50s, Yemenite Jews trying to get to Israel and walking hundreds of miles in order to get to an airlift. Many of them didn't make it. A lot of them died along the way. It's an amazing story. So I don't think the hardships that many Jews have had to make in order to immigrate to the United States are any less than the hardships of other immigrants moving to other countries, be it the United States or Canada or anywhere. So I do think you still have, even if it's a welcoming place, the getting there is really tough. And you're still starting anew. You're learning a new language. You're in a different world. You're in a different society. It's very difficult. I do think the Israelis have some unique policies on assimilation, on integrating them into the country, which I actually think very much are prescriptive to the United States. I think we cite some specific examples of policies that could work here in the United States that aren't unique to a sort of unitary Jewish culture.
Can you talk for a minute about the potential challenges to sustaining this growth that we've seen?
Yeah, I think that we have a chapter in the book called The Threats to the Economic Miracle, which looks at sort of what's not going right or what could really go wrong. And there are the obvious ones. If Iran develops a nuclear bomb, that is going to be a real threat, not only to Israel's economy, but to Israel existentially. But on the pure economic merits, there's under-participation in the labor force by certain demographics. The Haredi Jewish, the ultra-Orthodox Jewish community has low participation. The Israeli Arab population has low participation. We look at some of the reasons for why that is, and we also point to the fact that many smart Israeli academics and politicians, people like Benjamin Netanyahu, are very focused on this because they believe that if they can increase the participation rate, the labor participation rate of some of these demographics, so you have much fuller participation in the economy, there's no stopping Israel from becoming one of the top 10 or 15 largest economies in the world, which would be an amazing feat for a country of, 7.1 million people.
How transferable, you mentioned immigration policies. What else could we apply in this country without really changing the nature of life in the United States? We're not going to send every young person to the military, for example.
No, but for instance, we could do a better job of educating corporate leaders in the United States about the military experience that those people who are serving are getting. I mean, we tell this, lots of stories like the following in the book. Young junior officer.
We got about 15 seconds left, by the way. Sorry.
A young junior officer from Fallujah comes back, applying for a job in Silicon Valley, describing his experience in Iraq, tribal negotiator, security czar, reconstruction czar. At the end of the interview, the corporate recruiter says, "Well, that's all very interesting, but have you ever had a real job?" and that's because our corporate leadership, with some exceptions, are basically illiterate about the valuable leadership experience that our men and women are getting in the battlefield and how transferable it is to the United States business world. And so we show in the book how we can learn from the Israeli model in that sense.
Dan Senor's new book is called Startup Nation, The Story of Israel's Economic Miracle. Dan, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Great to be with you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think team includes assistant producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.